Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hi, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy. I'm Matthew Darlitz, Editor-in-Chief of The Neuropsychotherapist, and I'm here with my good friend, Richard Hill. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Matt. How are you doing?
Good, good. So, Richard, we have some great articles in our April issue of the magazine. We've got one of our resident experts, Ken Bernau, with an article called Catching the Wave, which is a case study about him working with a lady with ASD, and we get to learn a little bit more about his pro-being approach. Very interesting and an easy read.
Yes, I really like these case studies. I mean, you can't have them all the time, and but I like to mix them around because it's the science of psychotherapy. We want the science, but we also want the psychotherapy, and it's the intersection of the two. And so a case study is great, and Ken does a lovely job in interacting and interrelating the theoretical framework of his probing work, which is a lovely theoretical framework, and this actual case from the Jesse in Catching the Wave.
Yeah, and the second easiest, or maybe the easiest read in the whole magazine, is called Worried: Science Investigates Some of Life's Common Concerns.
Yes, Eric Chudler and Lise Johnson, who did this great book. Now, you know, getting things published is tricky in this world. And sometimes when you get something that says something really important in a very, very easy to read way that's appreciable to the general public, it can get a great exposure. And these two guys have done a wonderful job. Eric does this marvelous thing called Neuroscience for Kids, the website, and we'll give a link to that when we do that. Lise Johnson is, her stuff speaks for itself. Go check her out on the web. And they just produced this wonderful set of all these things that are in the world. What's the science behind them? And should we really worry about it? Or maybe not. And it's just great. And they have a little scale there. I love this book. I think it's got so much depth to it. But you actually can give it a fairly light read if you want. But you just keep going back and going, oh, no, that's actually really, ooh, that's really. So I love it. Yeah.
Beautiful. So if you're a subscriber, please have a read. If not, we'll leave some links in the show notes for the actual book. You can go get the book. Now, we have two articles in the middle of the magazine which kind of dovetail together quite nicely. Now, Richard, this is your area, isn't it? This is two articles by the Rossies, and, well, I understand you had a big part to play in the writing as well. And the first, Milton Erickson's Paths of Effective Psychotherapy, and that dovetails into this article about quantum field theory. And this is what I wanted to ask you about today, because, to be honest, I find some of the quantum stuff a little difficult to grasp. Now, I've really believed this is something very important that we need to understand, and I've gone out and I've got myself Quantum Physics for Dummies and String Theory for Dummies, and I tell you, I must be quite a dummy, because these are still challenging books. And yeah, they're full of
maths. Understand the dummy books. That's a great worry. I know. But I think it's something that warrants a discussion. Now, in the articles, I think you'll find it's really nice. Ernie and Catherine, and we talked a bit about it as well. I didn't contribute too much, but I was very fortunate to be able to put in a few ideas and thoughts. But it's looking at this nature of the many paths idea, Richard Feynman's many paths idea, and Erickson's idea of opening up many paths in order to find the one and allow the one with the most effective treatment to emerge. Yeah. And what are the relationships? What's the sort of spin in there? Because Ernest Rossi, is my dear mentor, so I'm familiar with him. But Ernest Rossi and Catherine have been working very hard on trying to look at where the quantum space can give us some deeper understanding of what is going on in the brain. And in the shorter article, they do dovetail in. That's why I've put them in together, so you can actually cross-reference. There's actually something really important that is in there that we'll talk about in a second. But let's actually just talk about quantum generally, because every time you say quantum, people seem to say, Oh, yeah, I know all about quantum. Quantum means I can do anything and be anywhere, and suddenly I'm connected to the universe, and actually I think I'm God.
Either that or people will just turn off because it just sounds too complex.
Yeah, this is ridiculous. So, this is crazy.
Right.
I've got no idea and I'm useless and hopeless, which is not the case at all. I think that where we're at with quantum at the moment is it's really interesting.
Okay, so could you just give us some quantum ABCs, some basics, so that
okay, let's just look at three or four of the fundamental aspects of quantum that we don't, as far as we know, experience in the macro world. This thing where you and I exist and can observe each other, but only occur in these very small areas, these very small places where it's largely only based on energy. And so energy potentials.
When you say small, we're talking subatomic.
Yes.
Is it that?
We're
yes.
talking about particles that occur within the subatomic space because of the energetic activities and stimulations that occur in that space.
Okay. So as long as people understand, this is not something that you can observe with a microscope. This is smaller still.
Absolutely. Now, we experience quantum activities in many, many different ways. So what in the Mirroring Hands book, even though it's a book about hypnotherapy and it's a book about the ways to behave in therapeutic space, it's to give we'd have a chapter on quantum, the quantum space, and the quantum, what we call the quantum qualia, where we feel something that is actually happening at a quantum level. Now, we can do that. One of the quantum qualia is a clock. And certainly the way time is regulated and organized and understood at the moment is what we call a quantum clock. It's looking at the fluctuations of energy that occur within the cesium atom. And it's a bit complicated because you're talking about movements of electrons on different levels within at the atomic level. And when it moves from one level to another and then back again, it excites the possibility, the electromagnetic possibility field, the light energy field, and a photon can emerge. So this sense of light can emerge. Mm-hmm. And the frequency, the wavelength of that light is very consistent. In atomic clocks, we use the cesium atom, and it's this movement between electron levels, and those frequencies we're able to get exact amounts of time, except for every now and again they have to do a leap second because the universe is strange.
Okay,
but let's have a look at this then. Let's go in just saying we do that, and I talk in the book about how our sense of smell requires a thing called quantum tunneling. We think possibly in photosynthesis we also use these transposing states. Although that's changing. So the ideas keep changing all the time. But the principle of understanding of the quantum, at the quantum level, something can be, and I'll cover two things at one time. Something can be local and measured as a particle, as a particle, a photon particle, or even as an electron particle, even though it's an energetic particle. Or it can be a wave and therefore is non-local. And potentially exists in all space, occupies all space.
Okay.
Now, one of the ways, the classic experiment that we've seen explaining that is the split, the splits in the metal splits, where you send light energy, so photons, towards a split, and when you're measuring it, when you're looking upon it in local space, it will form a normal pattern on the wall at the other side where the particles have moved directly through and hit the other side of the wall. But when you're not observing it and allowing it to be non-localized and wave-like, it will form an unusual banded expression on the back wall. So this is sort of a verbal description you're hearing. All right. So just go and check that.
What I'll do, I've just written down here to go and grab a video. I know there's a few really cool videos on YouTube. So if you're listening to this, go to the landing page when you get a chance and have a look. There's some great videos. It's much easier to understand when you're seeing it graphically than explaining it with words.
So that's really important. So that's a great one. And so click on there and look at that and see how these things can exist. We have the capacity at that level. Whereas, of course, as you and I, when we were talking about the early parts of it, people saying, well, if I go into the quantum state, that means I can walk out into a street and in front of a bus and it won't hit me because I can be in all places at once and I won't be in that one. Really not advised. In the macro world, these multiple positions, these superpositions don't exist like that because we don't know why yet.
Now, before we move, just with this particle wave duality, now there's something strange happening with observation, isn't there?
Yeah. See, observation creates locality. Mm-hmm. So therefore creates things that are local, which are particles. So when we localize, when we observe, we localize and create something that is measured, and it is in a particular place at a particular time, which is the place we're looking at, the time we're looking. And so there it is, and it becomes a photon particle. So when you're not having a localized view of it, then it shifts and is at the same time, but expresses its sense of being a wave.
So observation makes a fundamental difference down at that very small level. How does that translate into our macro world of observing things and paying attention to things? Is there
now? This is getting a little bit outside of my my mathematical framework.
Sure.
But fundamentally, we have it is from the energetic possibility fields that get fluctuations of activity that can happen through these movements. For example, the movements of electrons from one level to another that create particles that then very often have very, very short life frames. Mm-hmm. But as these particles increase in their activity, the activity that makes them emerge increases, they eventually coalesce and co-form into larger particles, which then become stable.
Okay.
Over time. So the argument might be that at the Big Bang, we had just this fluctuating energetic possibility. But as we had this enormous heat, we had this enormous pressure that was going on, that particles, instead of fluctuating in momentary existence, they actually became they became consistent and then became blended and then became large enough to become consistent and ongoing actualities of matter.
Okay. I've probably taken you away from the basic.
But that was pretty good. No, it was a really good question. It was a really good question.
Yeah.
Because in the quanta is just meaning very, it's the smallest packet. It's a packet of. It's a small measurement. And in the quantum world, you look in discrete packets. Mm-hmm. It's discrete packets of energy. It's discrete packets of energy that become a particle, become measured as a particle. It's discrete packets of wavelength, of frequency. So this aspect of this framework of thinking in the quantum world is very different from the macro world, because we're not discrete packets. We're functional and fundamental and fairly non-variable qualities and quantities.
Right.
Whereas in the quantum world, that variability is unpredictable, or much more unpredictable than in the macro world. This idea that it's very small is what's relevant, is what's important.
Okay. So when we go from the very small to the bigger, things become more predictable.
Yeah, well, when they become bigger because they become transitory possibilities and potentials and energy packets that become actualized into consistent and stable matter.
Right.
So that's the difference.
Okay. I think I've got that. I'm after some very simplistic, easy to grasp answers, and in the nature of things is not quite like that.
I mean, so in other words, we can't get down. We have no capacity to be in the quantum space because we're stabilized particles. In other words, we have to dematerialize into energetic inconsistencies.
Right.
So we don't want to be in the quantum world. We want to be in the macro world. But the quantum world produces, it produces light, produces energy, produces capacity. It produces the ability for energy to function and become actualized, which is what we call the quantum qualia, that we can feel the world. So we believe there are quantum processes that enable our smell system to work. So we can't feel the quantum action of quantum tunneling, where suddenly the information from this very minute energy travels across space in an instant. What we do, though, is we have the quantum qualia of the sense of smell.
Right.
So we're still connected to the quantum world. It is all still one integrated space. And we're trying to, I mean, mathematicians have been brilliant in trying to understand what is going on in, we've had string theory. What's the connection between quantum space and the macro world? Wonderful, I mean, it was really the work from Einstein when he first said that, photons are particles as well as waves. But interestingly, he found a great deal of difficulty with this idea of non-locality, that particles, you could get paired particles that have relationships with each other across space and time that were not measurable in the relationship to the speed of light. That was just sort of, weird and spooky for him. And it was not for another 20 or 30 years that we really began to understand. And the mathematicians began to get a better grasp of what, I mean, we had, Niels Bohr coming up with stuff in the 19 teens and 20s and moving on to a variety of others. There's all these amazing mathematical equations. And when we go to Feynman, which Ernie Rossi talks about in the article, Feynman talks about another way of trying to understand the quantum type of experience where all things happen in all space and all time, but we end up getting a fairly singular type of experience in the macro world. And he called that the many paths, or the path integral, where it's you understand the nature that all the weird and crazy and what we would think in the macro world, unrealistic possibilities, like of a particle going from A to B, but going via Jupiter or something like that. That actually those weird and wild ones, and the mathematics is quite interesting, it's quite interesting if you're interested. But the mathematics is they all cancel each other out in the same way that you have, an up wavelength and a down wavelength will cancel each other out. And what you end up is a collapse, is a resultant path, which is probably a reasonably straight one, the most likely one. Now you've got other theories of the way in which quantum can be understood, the Copenhagen theory, which is slightly different. It's called the collapse of possibilities, the collapse of possibility into a single element. That's more when you're looking at particles. So Feynman says, are these things all different, or are they just different ways to come to a reasonable conclusion that's similar? And that is probably where we are at now on the general level. Now, anybody who's listening to this who knows their quantum will sit there and say, geez, Richard could go to school for a little while longer. And that's absolutely true. There's a lot I don't understand. There's a lot of the mathematics that don't come to grasp. But these ideological understandings, I suppose that I want to express, is that there are activities that occur in the quantum space at the quantum level where energy is moving about in ways that are peculiar to the macro world,
yep.
still contribute to the existence of the macro world and our experience of it. That's the nature. It's not about being some magical thing that will give us, you know, unlimited energy or give us some mystical connection to being able to be everywhere, everything at all times.
Yeah, we were talking before the show about some of this, weren't we? That people have come up with all sorts of fanciful ideas based on a very superficial understanding of quantum, and they've made it a magical kind of blanket thing.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about some of these ideas, it may prove that some of them are true.
Right.
They may end up, the mathematics think, oh, yeah, well, we can do that. But to say it when we don't know is, so it's not, I don't know, I hesitate from calling it irresponsible, but I think it's irresponsible. I think it's self-serving. Saying, you know, follow me because I'll connect you to the quantum things which will give you greater powers than everybody else. It really feeds into my winner-loser world idea that I'm not good enough and I need to tap in somehow to some magic that's going to make me good enough. I swear to you, everybody is good enough. That doesn't mean the world isn't a place you struggle in, but you are good enough because you're alive. And that's an amazing, extraordinary thing. And I love this quote that I saw somewhere, I can't remember. It said, science, it's just like magic, but without the lies.
Okay, that's good. I like that. Yeah.
That doesn't mean that it doesn't have faults and errors and potential changes as time goes on. And that's what makes good ideas. Ideas, what did Florey say, that sit on the fingertips to be blown away by the merest fact.
Coming up with a self-serving idea out of a superficial knowledge of something like quantum, I think is a little bit different than having an open mind about possibilities that we really don't have the foggiest yet about. Because in my, you know, I've tried to read this Dummy's Guide to String Theory. And it seems string theory doesn't really make any sense or isn't even possible without, I think it's about 10 dimensions.
Yeah.
And I can't even get my head around what a fifth dimension would be like, let alone the 10th. And so if reality really does exist in so many other dimensions, which I can't even get my head around, then I'm assuming there's a lot of possibilities that I can't explain with my knowledge of classical physics, what we know of the three-dimensional world traveling through the fourth dimension of time. So
I think that the thing that is most interesting is that there's a very similar process that goes on in the quantum space that also goes on in the macro space, in what we talk about a lot with complex systems.
Right.
And this is something that really interests me as a realistic or a way of grasping what's going on. And what we talk about, Dan Siegel talks about this quite a lot too, and a lot of other people. John Arden was talking about this sort of stuff. And Ernie Rossi's been talking about it, but I've sort of got a bit of my own spin. But this fact that we have what we call a possibility field, where kind of everything is possible.
Yep.
And Dan quite rightly says that that's a great place to do healing in, because you want to be where you can grasp onto things different to the ones you've already got.
Yeah.
Because what happens in the possibility field is that the energy that flows across it, the influences that flow across the possibility field, will stimulate some things and will actually destimulate others, and some will cancel each other out because of the various fluctuations they have. And those things that get stimulated the most move up and then become what we call participants of the probability field.
Right. Right.
And then from those probabilities, we tend to then create actualities. So if your possibility field in the complex macro system of life, if your probability field has had waves of influence from trauma, perhaps from early trauma or negative attachment issues or something of that sort, then the sorts of probabilities that are going to emerge are defensiveness, negative self-image, difficulties with having relationships, perhaps the sorts of neurobiological functionings which gives you various forms of affective disorders or neurosis. Mm. And certainly these things we call the negative inner voice. This is what comes when the possibility field is influenced by the energetic experience of life creating probabilities, and then you have these actual negative experiences, actual anxiety attacks, actual, you know, these actualities.
Yeah, the peaks on top of the mountain, yeah. So coming up from the plane, yeah.
That's right. And so the idea is to come back. So we use mindfulness, mm-hmm. and of course you know that I talk about the fact that I think the best way to get back to the possibility field is through curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Mindfulness is great to calm you down from the actualities, down through the probabilities, and into this connected sense of self, mm-hmm. with the possibilities. And I think get mindfulness and then add curiosity, and you're away and dancing. Now, what's interesting though, this is what occurs in the quantum space.
Okay,
you have the possibility field of energetic possibility,
mm-hmm.
which has waves of influence that flow across that, and this could be just that simple example I've given of movement electrons on different levels within the atomic state, and that electron movement stimulates the photoelectric possibility field, which then activates photons to appear either as waves or particles, depending on the nature of the way in which that fluctuation is being experienced.
Mm.
And then when that wave is persistent enough, with enough pressure, with enough heat, as we had in the Big Bang, then these come up, coalesce, and become permanent matter.
Okay. I think that is probably one of the most helpful takeaways for me and for my work with clients, is to be able to paint that picture of this open plane of possibilities. And I've seen, these diagrams that Dan Siegel and others, have drawn, where you've got this open plane and then the little mountains with their plateaus and then peaks.
Yes, come to my workshop, the Myriads workshop. You'll see lots of that.
Okay. I think that's a really helpful frame of mind or just metaphor, really, to have in your mind, to open up yourself to, I mean, we can talk about rigidity and chaos and as well. And this is finding that middle of the river where there's a whole lot of more possibilities.
And I think if nature is using things in many places,
mm-hmm.
It's a very powerful tool.
Mm-hmm.
So nature is using this principle in quantum, or certainly that's the way we see it in the way we think mathematically.
Mm-hmm.
And nature seems to also use it in systems.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that actually nature even uses it in a lot of other areas. So it's really resonates with us.
Mm.
Now, the degree to which this process occurring, or this process occurring at the quantum field, is the quantum field creating fluctuations that enable energetic actualities to emerge into my systems possibility field that then come up and created things, and that is why I fall in love?
Right.
We don't know.
Mm, mm, mm.
But I kind of like the poetry of it.
Right.
So I'm going to sit open-minded and accepting and wait for the geniuses to produce it to me. But what we've talked about in our magazine is this fabulous insight through this bit of research by Bravi, Goster, and Koenig,
mm-hmm.
on how a quantum computer works.
Yep.
And that at a quantum level, we are able to solve problems much more readily and without as much complication as we need to do in the macro level,
mm.
where for every complication you need further gates, more zero ones,
right.
in computing, but we need further and more gates.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really interesting. It's more than I want to describe just in this discussion. So go have a look at the paper, and again, Ernest Rossi and Catherine Rossi and I are saying, wow, isn't this an interesting possibility? Is it a probability? Where can we take this? How can we engage with this and stay engaged with this as the theorists and also the practical people take the theory and as we move forward? The excitement that this gives us about the future is what is where we're at the moment. It's not about the excitement about what it's giving us at the present.
Right, right. As you're talking, I'm thinking about, you know, neuroplasticity. So we know all about, you know, your brain isn't fixed, your brain can change. This is kind of like plasticity on a whole nother level, isn't it? Like there is nothing fixed. There's a possibility of anything. I mean, within reason, not talking magical.
Well,
you know,
but it's to do with the nature of way the energy is transferred across the brain, and as Dan Siegel talks about the movement of energy, these packets of energy that move down the axon and across the synapse through various chemical processes. Jeffrey Schwartz wrote a book about this ages ago. He was talking about the quantum nature of the brain. Now we've had we were talking the other day about the work that you've seen a couple of years ago, but I've seen some replays of this, of the microtubules, which are the way in which discrete packets, they're not so quantum packets, but they're the that are carried down through. But they're the proteins that are carried down through the brain, the axon. Sorry, carried down through the axon along the microtubules from the cell area from the creation down to the axon, to the synapse, to enable to be utilized, and this microtubules are forming and unforming all the time, and that there's possibilities that has quantum relationships because it's energetic draws them together. This is great.
Yeah.
Does it actually change the way we function on a day-to-day basis now? I would say probably not. Could you not really know any of this stuff and still have a fantastically happy life? Probably. Is it just incredibly, screamingly exciting about additional things in the possibility field? Yes, indeed it is.
Well, certainly, and I just pulled this up and I'll put a note for listeners to go to this article about this microtubule, because I remember that back in 2012, that's a while ago now, we published something about this. Is Stuart Hameroff and Sir Roger Penrose and their orchestrated objective reduction theory of consciousness. And Stuart Hameroff, he talks about this quantum, it's like a quantum communication network. And he was saying that there is communication that happens across the nervous system instantaneously, like not through the traditional neural communication network, but actually on a quantum level instantaneous, which could be measured but couldn't be explained except through, you know, quantum theory. Very interesting, because this opens up a whole lot of possibility when we talk about, you know, neural networks. So we know that there's neural networks, and then there's the glial network. But then we also have layered on that again is maybe a quantum, I don't know if you call it a network, a quantum something.
Well, what we're doing is we're seeing movements of information across the brain just based on the energetic potential of particles. So whether it is a more positive or a more negative particle, and so there's lots of aspects there. I think one of the things is, I think it encourages us to not be so reliant upon changing things at the macro level. Certain types of perhaps drug-based treatments, perhaps impositional treatments, perhaps directive type of therapies.
Sure.
And that there's actually a framework of communication that has a naturalness that we can have more confidence in, because we've been operating without the sorts of therapeutic processes and a lot of the biochemical contributions, the pharmacological contributions for quite some time. But I say that in the context that there's a hell of a lot of pharmacological benefit that stops us dying at a lot of a young age. But it's just this thing here that these discrete packets of energy that occur at the quantum level, and this just difficult idea to understand that they may operate at frequency and wavelength levels that perhaps occur across all space at any given moment, that can't be explained through transfer of information at the speed of light.
Right, yeah.
So that's where we're at the moment. Now, what does that mean for day-to-day life and whether I go and buy sweet potatoes or Pontiac potatoes?
Right.
Sure, I get it. But isn't it exciting? There were many, many, many years ago when Lee Wonhoke first, showed us how to look down through a ground glass in a particular way, and to see that within the blood there were moving cells, and within those cells there were moving elements, and then eventually down to DNA. Then someone found the electron microscope, and so we go down. Before Lee Wonhoke and that sort of aspect of investigation, we were much, much simpler. Did people still survive? Did they still have make love? Did they still have babies? Sure.
Of course, yeah.
But I'm kind of excited about this space.
Yeah, yeah. And eventually things will filter up from this science to help us do therapy better. I doubt if there's going to be quantum therapy anytime soon.
Maybe not soon. And maybe the therapy that we do will 200, 300, 1,000 years from now, we'll say, wow, isn't that brilliant? They were doing quantum. That's a quantum therapy there. And we'll go, wow, we didn't know. But I think that essence of the best part of quantum is there's stuff we don't know, and it's exciting. And it gives us a sense of having a greater connection to the possibilities of life than those things that we can imagine and that we can see structured in front of us.
Yeah, yeah, brilliant.
And that's the metaphor that excites me.
I'd just like to encourage readers when they're reading, these sort of articles in the Neuropsychotherapist, our intention is just to be, again, opening up our minds and to the possibilities. Not that you have to really, understand all of this or you're not a good therapist. It's not that at all. We're giving you the leading edge of where the science is going. Just absorb what you can.
And on the other side of it, if you are actually up on this stuff and you're listening to what I've said, and there's some stuff I've said that's not well said or could be explained better. Oh, come on, come in on the thing.
Absolutely.
Add your comments, add your knowledge, because I struggle with this. Matt's very kindly is willing to say he struggles even more than me. And then, of course, I work with the beautiful Ernest Rossi, who says he still struggles. So, but I think when you start reading things by Penrose and there's some wonderful stuff. Philip Ball has got some terrific video on it, which other people, mathematicians, come in and say he talks rubbish and no one knows what I love it. I love it. I love the excitement of the possibility and that as we go along. Meanwhile, I love my partner. I have my great friends. I open up to my own possibilities just on the macro level.
Brilliant. Well, thanks, Richard, for taking us through that. And
Putting you through that.
It really is very interesting, and looking forward to reading more and learning more and understanding more myself. Before we leave, let me just mention that this show is being sponsored by the International Association of Applied Neuroscience. They have their first international conference coming up, and that's in May 22nd to 24th. And John Arden, our good friend John, he's going to be doing a pre-conference workshop, and he will be the keynote speaker, or one of the keynote speakers. They've got a bunch of really great speakers coming up for that conference. So we'll leave a link in the show notes for that one. And I just want to mention also that we're always trying to make things simpler to navigate and understand on our website. And so what I've done with our course material, and we've got course material that some of it we've done internally and some of it we work with partners. And so we've got a whole bunch of resources available to you. And what I've done is I've just created one landing page. It's, if you're on the main menu, it's just learning or all courses on the top menu. I'll throw up a graphic so you can see where that is. And on that page, you will see all of our courses, from reading courses that are for our members, academy courses, and courses by third parties, our partners. And it's all there in, you know, for the magazine, neuroscience, mind, body, psychopathology, trauma, whole lot of different topics there. So just trying to make it a little bit more simple to navigate. So I encourage you to jump on, have a look at that. Richard, thanks again.
Thank you, Matt. That was a beauty. I hope it's been helpful. If not, if it's been confusing, go out and figure out what's this and let me know.
Okay. Brilliant. We will catch you again next week on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. Thanks for tuning in.
Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.